Hello again, and welcome to South Beach Sessions. I'm Dan Lebatard, and over the last few years, we've been delighted to get to know, and he's become a friend, Hank Azaria, the voice actor for a generation. I mean, he's 21 of the Simpsons voices, a wildly talented person. I'm always flipping through the channels, and he's in a movie, whether it's Gross Point Blank or Heat or Birdcage, where he had a breakout role. I saw him in Dodgeball the other day as Patches O'Houlihan. He has had a lot of Hollywood stuff that has been fun to watch. He's been funny for a really long time. And so I wanted to talk to him about his career and how he became who he became, which is sort of the thing that we explore often with folks here on South Beach Sessions. But before we get to Hank, here is Mike Ryan to tell you who this week's sponsor of South Beach Sessions is. We remind you again, please support the people who support us. They're the ones who are keeping all of this free for you, everything at the Lebatard and Friends Network. Mike, tell the people who's sponsoring this week's South Beach Sessions. So, Hank, I imagine that your childhood was very lonely because everyone I've met who's got any actual voice talent, Robin Williams, as an example, they just had profoundly lonely childhoods where their imagination was their best friend. So without having even talked to you about this ever, it's what I imagine. Is that so?
Yeah. In a word, yes. No question. It's funny. That'd be interesting. Like, I'd love to ask other guys like Frank Caliendo, other guys who very specifically developed mimicry and voice up as a skill, if that was true of them. I think it's probably generally true of almost everybody in show business. But no question, a lot of time in my room with imaginary friends, literally imaginary friends, a lot of time in front of the TV by myself, just mimicking, imitating what I heard and saw.
What was happening in the family life that made it lonely?
You know, my parents were together, but my dad was like a lot of men of that era, a complete workaholic. And just, you know, he loved what he did. He was a garmento, as we called him in New York. He was had his own textile clothing manufacturing business in the Garment Center in New York. Loved it. And just that was his baby. You know, I was his baby, but that was his baby. You know what I mean? And my mother was a little checked out, like many women of that era as well. The mother's little helper thing. And I was the third child of, I have two older sisters. They're 10 and 12 years older than I am. And I think my parents were a little done. I think I might've been a surprise, Dan. And I think my parents were, had moved on to the next phase of life. And there I was, like, oh, look at this thing. There's a television. Let's stick him in front of that. That'll work.
Is that why you're such a present father now? Is that why you are an extraordinarily present father among the people that I know in my life in terms of the time that is allotted for your child is for him? Is that the reason?
Yeah, that's one of the top reasons for sure. I you know, although it did, and I talk a lot, not just with other voice actors, but other artists in general, if I may be so bold as to call myself an artist, I pose this poll question to them. Do you think you would have become as successful as you've become or developed your talent and skill to the level that you did if you did not have a lonely childhood or a difficult childhood? I think the answer probably is no. I think everybody would have been talented and maybe enjoyed that gift and craft, but I don't know that you can become, you have the kind of obsessive drive that's necessary unless you are compensating or overcompensating for what you didn't get. And yeah, I not all that was fun. A lot of that was very difficult, led to addiction and codependency and my own version of workaholism and all kinds of not and perfectionism, and not fun things that I would spare my son if I could.
But that also made you great. Are you basically saying that Hollywood is built atop bad parenting?
The world might be, Hollywood for sure. I don't know too many people in Hollywood in front of or behind the camera or in executive positions or anywhere connected to it. Essentially everybody in that business, I'm not being flippant when I say has run away and joined the circus. You know, you don't do that unless you're running from something. I don't think.
Well, so how did it happen with you? Like, where did it go from struggling to make this a career to actually feeling like you had succeeded? Like, where were the doubts? Where along the path, where did you stumble along? Did you struggle a lot?
Relatively, no. I had a very easy path for two reasons. One was because aforementioned workaholic father had made enough money to, you know, I don't think my parents approved of or of my choice to become an actor, nor did they think it would work out. But they were kind enough to, I think, give me enough rope to hang myself. When I got out of college, they were like, my father was, all right, I'll support you for a while. Try it. And he did. I had to work. I mean, I bartended and catered. And
what were you studying in college?
I studied drama and psychology.
So they knew you were on this path. They knew that.
Oh, yeah.
That, and so, okay, you could try it for a little while. But you said you think they didn't support it? Like, did you ask?
Yeah, I mean, I asked. They weren't. I know they weren't crazy about it. But they, I think they didn't know what to do with me at that point and were happy that I had any even idea of what to try. So they're like, well, all right, try that. And they and myself assumed I would be back in grad school for psychology by the time I was somewhere between 27 and 30. But you know, to my way of thinking, in college, I spent all my time in the theater. So I sort of voted with my feet, as they say. I found that was all I really liked to do was work on this production or that production. And then I figured rather pragmatically, uncharacteristically of me, I had a pretty sober thought like, well, if I'm going to try this, I should do it when I'm young and fail at it when I'm young. And then I will not be old by the time I revert to grad school or whatever. And started working almost right away, Dan. I mean, I didn't become a star, not, you know, very consistently, but I got an agent sort of right away, 21 years old, like old fashioned style, like somebody chased me down a hall. Are you represented by anybody, kid? No. Can I send you out? Sure. And she did. And I got a couple of those jobs and, you know, a line or two here and there, but got my union card, got a job in LA, went out there and within, there's a lot of details to that, but basically within a year, got my first couple of decent TV jobs and got The Simpsons within a couple of years of that. And then that gave me a steady paycheck for the rest of my life.
So which was the big break? The Simpsons? The big break where like, oh, I don't have to worry about anything anymore. Like this is absolutely going to be a lucrative career.
The Simpsons was week to week at first for a year and a half for me. And every week, by the way, Dan, I thought it was going to be my last week because they did not seem very pleased with what I had done. Sam Simon ran the show then, and he was like, I was very young and green, and I would record. I didn't know what I was doing. God knows why they hired me. I did some good voices, you know, and they liked them. So they literally threw me up there. But I was so green, I didn't know how to sell a joke or timing or anything. And Sam would make this face a lot after I recorded. He'd go,
like he smelled something bad.
Exactly. For your listening audience, like you smelled something bad. And then he would kind of spoon feed me the line reading or how to do it. And that's how I learned the first like couple of years, that and watching Dan Castellaneta and Harry Shearer, who I consider, and everyone there, Yardley Smith and Nancy Curry, they're all brilliant. But Dan and Harry to me were, I idolized them. They were just like so fully committed to what.
How did you realize that the Simpsons environment is a crazy different environment by high-end intellectuals? Like how did you realize that what you were dealing with was not any kind of normal, that you were working with genius?
Well, I had already known that James L. Brooks, who created the show, was a genius. I mean, that guy is a television legend 32 years ago. Mary Tyler Moore Show, Taxi. And the rare, certainly back then, the rare unicorn of a person who then transitioned into film and would win Oscars, you know, for his writing, directing with, you know, Terms of Endearment and Broadcast News. And other movies. So, you know, Jim was a brilliant writer, brilliant director, and he had a vision for this thing combined with Matt Groening and the aforementioned Sam Simon. And those guys, what Jim had going from them was the early days of Fox. And so you didn't even know if the network were going to continue to exist, let alone this crazy primetime cartoon show. But Jim was so powerful that the network, we'd get notes all the time and he would just wave a middle finger at the network. And we were completely untouched by network hands. And we were just allowed to do what everybody, every writer felt like doing. And Jim had the wisdom, much like the movie studio system in the 1970s, to hire all these young, brilliant writers and just let them do their thing. You know, I mean, not that I would put myself in that category, but even hiring me was bizarre. Like, that kid can do voices, hire him. It's like, you know, nobody else would really hire me then. So,
but you're the voice actor of your generation, right? Like, you're humble, but you keep doing these things where you tell me how not impressive you are. But there, who would even qualify to be your rival as the voice actor of a generation, given how many voices you do on that show?
Well, I could mention some at least rivals, if not like Seth MacFarlane, for example, who not only does all these incredibly funny voices on Family Guy, but writes all of it and has created it himself. He's like Matt Groening, Jim Brooks, and myself rolled into one over there. So you can make a strong argument for Seth. You know, Dan Castellaneta is an unbelievable voice artist. And you know, just on the strength of Homer Simpson alone, you could say that there are some other guys who you maybe not know who they are, but guys.
Well,
like,
if I don't know who they are, they can't be the voice actor of my generation, Hank.
I guess maybe not. But to me, you know, guys like John DiMaggio and Rob Paulsen. I mean, these guys are unbelievable.
But hold on a second. How do you go then from not knowing what your career is going to be, but you're going to try acting, you're going to try drama, to voice actor success, to having a moment there? I would imagine, you tell me if I'm wrong, that the Birdcage movie made you be able to dream about being a movie star.
Forgive my vacuum cleaner noise. To answer your question and to circle back to what you asked about the sort of big break question, my career has had incredibly incremental series of mini breaks that were all significant to me, but I didn't have like the lightning in a bottle. Oh my God, you're Walter White, you know, on Breaking Bad. Everybody knows you are, you know, or you're the Twilight movie guy, Robert Pattinson. That's your huge thing. The Simpsons I got when I was 22 or 23. It was a steady paycheck. But even that took a year or two to turn into that. And so that enabled me to, you know, quit bartending and pursue other roles without, you know, worrying about eating. And then I got a job on a silly sitcom in the 80s on Fox called Herman's Head in my 20s. And I learned a lot doing that. That was an even bigger paycheck. And so that was kind of a good break. But neither of them were put you over the top. You don't worry for the rest of your life. Then when that show ended, Herman's Head ended, I'm like 28, 29 years old. I really just pestered my agent. So I was like, how come I don't go out for movies? And back then, everybody goes out for everything and is considered for everything. And there's kind of no difference anymore. And there's getting less and less of a difference. But back then, you're either a movie person, a voiceover person, or a TV person. And I was a voiceover person and sort of a TV person. And they threw me out on a few auditions. And I booked a quiz show with Robert Redford, which was like, you know, I couldn't believe I did. I'm like, wow, really?
Wait a minute. You couldn't believe that you were acting opposite Robert Redford in a very good movie, Quiz Show. You couldn't believe that you were there.
He was directing, not on camera. But no, but you had John Turturro and Ray Fiennes and all kinds of amazing people. And no, I could not, Dan. It's funny. I would say, I don't know if this is going to sound overly arrogant or overly humble, but each step along the way of my career, I was surprised. Like, people would hire me and I'd go, really? You know, like, including like even when I just jumped out at an open mic night at a stand-up club at the Comedy Store, I got hired. I wasn't even trying to get hired. They hired me. I'm like, really? You're going to hire me? So I think what I discovered along the way is I have an affinity for this. And then my obsessive, aforementioned, rather addictive, sad childhood personality kicked in, and I was like a dog with a bone and wouldn't let things go. And then I auditioned for a quiz show and I got it. And that kind of stamped my passport a bit. And then that led to, like, that stint I did on Friends, I think, was a direct result, for example, of getting Quiz Show. It's sort of, I got a little fancier as an actor. And then that led directly to The Birdcage. Mike Nichols saw me in Quiz Show, thought, liked me in that, and offered me a role in Birdcage, which at the time was a small one, and then grew. And that was Birdcage is probably all that. Birdcage was my big break.
If you have to, all right, we'll get to that in a second. But would that character even fly today? Would you play that character the same way today? For those of you who don't know, Birdcage, Hank was a flamboyantly gay Cuban man.
I would play it the same way today. I just wouldn't get the opportunity. And I would agree with my not getting the opportunity. That if that role were being cast today, if they did a remake or a sequel, I promise you, it will be a Latin gay man who plays it as well it should. I did my best with it, put my heart and soul into it as I do with all. And, you know, look, I grew up in a Spanish-speaking household. There's gray areas with these things. I mean, my mom and dad are both Sephardic Jews, and Ladino was the first language they spoke. And so... And I'm imitating my maternal grandmother in that
role. It's a great character, Hank. Like, I understand that a lot of things have changed in 2020, but and furthermore, if anyone would be upset by the fact that they gave the role to somebody who wasn't Latin, it would be the guy who's always complaining that really we had to make Scarface with Al Israel. Like, that's the best we could do because we can't find any Latin characters. But I don't speak for gay people on whether that's an offensive character or not. I thought if it was going to be offensive, it might be as offensive to Latin people as it was to gay people.
By the way, so did I, Dan. You know, when we were making that, it was a big, the whole movie was a big swing for the time, let alone my character. And I was aware it was kind of a big break. I would shoot up in bed in the middle of the night, I swear to you, in the middle of shooting it, like, what am I doing? I hope I'm not offending the known universe with this thing. And that was, you know, 25 years ago when we weren't so on to all this. I just did what I always do, which is I tried to be as meticulous as I could with the specifics of not just a Latin accent, but a Guatemalan accent. I worked up a character. I had two versions of the character that I presented. I happen to have had a friend who was a cross-dressing drag performer, and I showed it to him. And I grew up, you know, in New York, hearing the Puerto Rican street queens were just part of my life, you know, every day. So it sounded to me like some guys I knew.
Did a great job with the role. I don't want you slinking away from this role. For the time, it was okay. I understand we're in a different time now and everything's changing. We're tearing down statues and Aunt Jemima can't be on a bottle of syrup anymore. But the character that you played all those years ago for the time in a different sensibility was a great character. And then what happened? Then because people were like, whoa, holy shit, this guy is really good at this. You get your choice of roles at that point? Like, at that point, can you become a top five movie star if your next three choices are monsters?
Yes, at that point, that really stamped my passport, as we would say, The Birdcage. And, if you're lucky enough, you get a moment then as an actor to, you get offered roles, you get to star in movies, and I made a mistake that I wouldn't make now. I wouldn't audition. I felt like I had auditioned so much at that point. I found it so fraught. I didn't want to audition anymore. And that was a mistake. I should have, you know. I was like, come on, everybody knows what I can do. Give me roles. And what do they know? They knew I was able to do that role in The Birdcage.
Was that ego or you just had that kind of power at that point that you didn't have to audition because you crushed the role?
Both. I obviously got away with it. I kept working, but it was foolish. There were many roles I think that were gray areas. They weren't ready to offer me, but that if I had met them halfway, I might have gotten. But in the meantime, I did have enough momentum in to get. It probably led into three movies that I had pretty big parts in: Godzilla and Mystery Men. And Mystery Alaska. And, you know, Mystery Men and Mystery Alaska are actually kind of sweet, cute, funny movies. And Godzilla was not as bad as they made out, but none of them performed well at the box office. Godzilla became the symbol of Hollywood foolishness for the time of like style over substance and hype over content. So they really, that really hurt my career. Like you get pinged right back into the next level or two down.
And you thought you were making a safe bet with Godzilla, right? Because how could that mess?
Absolutely. These guys had just done Independence Day. It wasn't a great movie, but it was a huge hit. So I figured this thing doesn't have to be great. It's going to be gigantic. And the ad campaign was huge. The anticipation was huge. And boy, did it backfire. I mean, it actually was detrimental to my career. Not help out for a while. But then what I didn't realize then is, you know, this whole career, and even if that had all worked out the greatest, and I went on to star in three more movies and they were hits, at some point, you're going to face the music. Like, careers go cyclically. Always.
Well, you get, I've heard you say this before, you get those three movies, right? You have the Birdcage role, you will get three opportunities. You better choose wisely. Godzilla seems like a good choice. I've told you before, I loved Mystery Men. Looking back on it, that's a funny choice to make with your three genie wishes. Like, just because it couldn't possibly work, even though it had to be funny as the script, because I liked what you guys were trying to do. I thought that was a funny, brave choice. And I don't think anyone's ever said that about Mystery Men.
No, I agree with you. Some of it is luck of the draw. You know, you ride the horses that are available to be ridden at the time, unless you're some kind of genius or
visionary. But what are the roles you look back on with lament? Because you're like, I should have just auditioned for that. My three choices could have been blank. Instead of Mystery Alaska, Mystery Men, and Godzilla, my three choices could have been blank, blank, and blank.
You know, there's nothing stands out like this specific, like, man, that those three roles, I should have gone in and read, and maybe I would have gotten them instead of. There were a bunch of roles like that, and many of them good. I don't remember exactly which they were, but it's very possible that at least one of those movies would have been replaced by something else I got, and maybe that would have turned out better. But I had a ton of near misses apart from that. Like, you know, Spike Jones is a really talented director, was going to direct this really cool version of Harold and the Purple Crayon, kind of a kid and adult fantasy thing. And me and Janine Garofalo, and that just never.
You would have been great in that. Good God, that would have been good for you.
And then also, that great director, Alexander Payne, he basically offered me the Paul Giamatti role in Sideways and then changed his mind a couple of years later. I had, like, everybody has a bunch of near misses where you're like,
I want the best ones. I'm surprised you haven't, as neurotic as you are, I'm surprised you haven't more hyper examined some of those choices, just because, like, I view you as a wild success, but I don't know how you Hollywood types think. Like, Alec Baldwin thinks his career is a failure, and I'm looking at him like, what are you talking about? And he's like, well, I was never leading man. I never really carried a movie. And it just seems ridiculous to me. Like, you have achieved, correct? You feel like you have done the most with your gifts.
I mean, it depends on what day you ask me, and depends on whether I'm looking at things at glass half empty or half full, which now circles back to a very a conversation about security and sobriety and, you know, positivity. And one of the things why I'm a happier person now is I do look at things like that. Like, look at what I have achieved is great. You can't win them all, you know, and you certainly can, you know, every comedian will tell you they'll be killing in an audience and they'll focus on the two guys who aren't laughing for some reason. And that ruins their night. And people get that way about their careers too, you know. But these three, they just didn't pan out for me. You know, but what about the 17 that did? So no, I don't really lament any of that stuff. I mean, most of it was out of my control. I didn't like make bad. It's not like I made a horrible. I know some people who made really bad choices. Well, like, it was in their power to make the choice. They made it, like, ooh, that's rough.
Well, when you talk about sobriety, though, and when you talk about addiction, what was happening in your life then? Did you get to Hollywood and just fast lane? This is crazy. From my lonely childhood, I've got money now. I'm having success that's coming pretty easy to me. Is that where I'm working as a bartender before that? Like, when did it happen where you felt like, oh, wait, I might be addicted to a good time?
I'm the kind of strange person that would come in and out of my life. You know, I have an addict soul, but it can be applied to anything. Drinking and drugs, sure. I just don't have a very strong physical constitution for drugs, so I could never go too far down that road. Booze a little bit more, but I'm still kind of a lightweight. Didn't take much to get me plastered, which was sort of fortunate when I was looking to get plastered. It didn't take much, but I'm much more at heart a codependent. Like I'd like to find other crazy alcoholics and take on their problems, whether it's in a love relationship or in a work relationship, and see if I can like distract myself from my own problems with their insanity. Work is a tremendous drug for me. And you know, the hours, as you know, I mean, work can suck you right in, man. I mean, it's just like the perfectionism that goes along with it and the obsession. And
I've gathered that you need your wife's help to sort of keep you on schedule there. Like, and that's without knowing anything, really. I've just gathered that it'd be real easy for you to lapse into doing 20 hours of creative stuff a day because you're running manic on the fuel and the feel good of like, look at this thing I'm creating.
I've gotten pretty good actually at self-regulating that. The thing is this. I call anytime you get it, like I'm completely sane with that as a civilian, but when I have to go shoot Brockmeyer as an example, I'm a complete workaholic because it's sanctioned workaholism. That is what it requires. I mean, a 12-hour workday is by its nature, insane workaholism, you know, and that's the minimum. Like it turns into 13, 14, 15 hours very often. So, and if you're producing it also, and so you're the boss and the star and
it's cocaine. It's creative cocaine.
Yes. So I accept the fact that in short bursts, I do that way. But I'm very aware that I am entering into a very unhealthy zone and a deal with the devil.
But it feeds you. But it feeds you. Yes, it's an unhealthy zone, but you're headed into doing 17 straight days of Brockmeyer, and it is ego masturbation the whole time because you know it's great and you're at the center of it and you're the star and you're meticulously crafting this thing that's funny and yours.
I wouldn't call it, there's some of that, but I wouldn't call it pure ego masturbation. It's more the work itself. In fact, half of it's fueled by this sucks. This is terrible. We're failing. You know what I mean? That's an equal, you know, where I don't know how this is going to turn out. I mean, I do know though that in order to make it the best thing it can be, I need to be obsessively meticulous, you know, about it and stay on top of every detail. It's more that energy and you kind of, how it turns out, you hope for the best, but, so yeah, I refer to show business as my drunken uncle. Okay. It's like this crazy, delightfully charismatic guy you love who literally one second will give you a big kiss on the forehead and an award. And the next minute slap you right in the face because he's tired of you. You know, and then it's different the next day. I mean, that's showbiz.
And so what happened? You go in and out of it. Did Hollywood seduce you in any way in terms of fast lifestyle?
I don't think I was ever, well, I had a phase where I turned into like fast lane guy, but for the most part, I would switch. I think maybe because I'm a character actor at heart, I don't know. I'll switch up the addictions. Like I would do like, I'll drink much too much for a few months and then like, oh, it's not good. And then I'll stop. And I'll go to the gym like a nut for, you know, 4 months, get in crazy shape. And then, rediscover pot. Like, yeah, this is nice. And they're like, well, too much. Like, I'm up all night, you know, stoned playing video games. This is not a no way to live. And then, cupcakes are good, aren't they? You know, and then so I'll put on like 20 pounds and like, hey, wait a minute. So work, huge one. You name it, I do it addictively. And that's why it took me, I think, a long time to get onto myself because I would round robin it, you know, for so long. And before it became like a real life crashing problem, I would sort of switch out. But mostly the steady, what I kept coming back to were really unhealthy relationships, especially love relationships with women where, believe me, I was at least 50% of the problem. I'm not blaming these women. I was a big accident waiting to happen. And going back to the childhood thing, I don't blame my parents either. They did the best they could with the information they had and they gave me a lot better than they got. But, you know, you know, the I was trying to fill voids from my childhood without knowing I was doing that, and it led to really big problems. And man, my alcohol bottle, I got sober 14 years ago, and that was hard, you know. It was hard to, that first year or two was very hard not to drink and this and that. It was nothing compared to my codependency bottom, compared to like getting over these relationships that didn't work out. I was devastated. And I was like, I can't go through this again. I think I've been through it like five times in my life, where like a year has been like grieving. It's like that level. I was like, I can't do it again. I got to fix this. And thank God there was a program for it, the Al-Anon program, codependency. And I really went and looked at what it is, what I'm doing here, and was able to recover.
Well, explain that to me, because I'm not familiar. What is happening there that you're reaching some sort of bottom on? I am addicted to codependency. I am hurting myself and I am hurting women. When you say it happened five times, what are we talking about there? Like, you were married to Helen Hunt. Like, I don't want to get too personal there, but is that one of the five times where you're just sort of stuck in one of these things and you don't know how to get out, and you're addicted to being stuck?
Yeah, that was the last time. Thank goodness. That was 20 years ago. That's what really launched me into recovery. That was like, I can't do this again. But I was engaged to somebody else in my 20s, had another really serious love relationship. I had three other really serious love relationships before then, all through my, you know, 20s and into my 30s. And each one I took really, really hard. And the best way I can put it is this, essentially, I'm recreating, there's a term for this now, it's called trauma mastery, where you literally recreate the circumstances of your childhood without realizing it, so that you can heal it ultimately, if you can. But while that's going on, that is not a picnic at all. You're essentially reopening a wound from when you were a kid. And I would do that over and over again. And my particular flavor, Dan, was I was so terrified of my own. I just didn't want to face my own crap. I didn't want to face my own wound. I didn't want to face the stuff that made me lonely and scared and that I didn't get as a kid. So I was like, please, anyone, especially a woman I'm attracted to, who I think is talented and funny and beautiful, let me just follow you around. And we'll get in all your craziness and we'll try to fix that. And we'll avoid my stuff. And then, but that doesn't, it works for a while, like any drug that will work for a while. And then there comes a day where you're like, well, wait a minute, what about me? And they're like, well, what about you? That's not the deal we have. The deal is we worry about my stuff and you follow me around. And then that leads to a lot of resentment. And then you become a pretty angry guy. I did. You get like, what do you mean? You know, like, it's my turn, but it isn't your turn. And it's a mess. It's codependent.
Holy shit, though, Hank. You're doing this with a Hollywood starlet. Like, Helen Hunt at that point can have all the roles that she wants. Like, is that not typical sort of Hollywood power dynamic couple stuff that can come in there and be dangerous?
I mean, I get, I look at it much less as Hollywood power couple dynamic stuff and more as just the human nature of codependency. I mean, it doesn't matter whether you're doing it over, no, I want to go do this movie and you can't do that TV show, whether you're doing it over, but what about, you know, my job in the ER and your law firm job? I don't think it really makes much of a difference. It is what it is.
Oh, but what if people are watching all the time, though? Like, yes, okay, fair enough. They're different because, you know, other people have lives that don't have that spotlight on it. But when you are dating or when you're married to Helen Hunt, are you not famous enough at that point to feel like, you know, not Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt, but you are too legitimate. You're people who are a famous couple, and those things always get more difficult when the famous marry the famous.
I think that only really came into play, Dan, when we were splitting up and that became public. Like, nobody needs that. It's hard enough, right? Going through a divorce, going through a breakup. Then now everybody's, you know, checking it out via the tabloids or whatever. But even that, nobody really cares. My shrink used to talk about, he called it the 15-minute rule. He's like, yeah, he should talk like this. He goes, yeah, people look, but they don't really give a shit after 15 minutes about anything else but themselves anyway, so they forget about it. And it's true. Like, nobody really cared. But it wasn't fun to be going through all that.
Well, I was
going to
say, that's what the perspective of, look, how many years, how much therapy, how much healing of the wounds. Like, I imagine while you were in it, it had to be deeply unpleasant, and you didn't have this perspective then.
Honestly, I haven't thought about this in a long time. There wasn't all that much. That was a really hard experience. And for her too, getting over marriage is rough. And, you know, you miss the person terribly that you know isn't right for you. And it's terrible. But that was maybe, you know, the public nature of it was maybe what was 6% of what was difficult about all that, you know? Yeah, there were moments where I'm standing online at the grocery store and I'm not feeling particularly great. And I glance over and I see a picture of my ex-wife with some guy. I'm like, well, this is not a great moment in my life. So it makes it harder to kind of put out of sight, out of mind. But that's really about it. Other than that, I think it is what it is for everybody.
You must have some stories about working with Robin Williams on Birdcage that you must, like, what are the memories that you have? And were there any of the signals of sort of tortured genius that you could see while doing that with Robin Williams, an obvious comedy legend by any standard?
Yeah, I'll say this about Robin. I worked with him a few times. By far the sweetest, one of the sweetest men I ever met, and I think hands down the sweetest movie star. He definitely, you know, what you think of as Robin Williams, just that guy who goes off and will improvise based on two words you say to him. He is that guy for real. And it was hilarious. Like at the craft service table in the morning over a bagel, and he'd be like, "How was your weekend, Cappy?" He called me Cappy, or boss. I'd say, "It was good. You know, I went bowling." He would do 20 minutes on bowling, as you would imagine Robin Williams would, bowling. So the ball, you know, it would go off. And I would look around like, and it was only me there. It's like, this was a performance that I was used to him doing on late night.
But did it seem happy to you? Because I always thought that there was sort of a neediness in that. And I've seen the documentaries where he too had a lonely childhood. There was always this neediness for the applause. Not that all entertainers don't have some of that, but with him, it seems stark to me as an outsider.
Yeah. I mean, when we were shooting The Birdcage together, which was when I knew him best, he seemed pretty happy and at peace. His comedy, his style is fraught even by comedian standards. So I think you need look no farther than that to see sort of a window into his soul. You know, by the same token, he had another mode, which was really not introspective so much as it was interested in his fellow man. You know, he would really, you know, once he got past his 20 minutes on bowling, he really was curious, how are you? How are you doing? And not just me, people on the crew, anyone. You know, this kind of sums up Robin. Like, we were shooting at Paramount. Tours would go by, you know, folks in big old golf carts, you know, being led around in a tour of the studio. Every actor's instinct is to run and hide from that. You're working, you're trying to. Robin would see them and go to them and stop the cart and do 15 minutes for them. I think it was a combination of his neediness. He needed everybody to adore him and laugh at him, and also his genuine giving soul. You know, he really wanted to entertain people and give them a happy memory.
What do you think of as the creative project that birthed the most just daily fun, joy in the doing? That it wasn't grinding work, it was just a lot of laughter every day, or mostly laughter every day? Or do you bring an element of sort of grind to everything you're doing?
I bring an element of grind to everything I'm doing. I've learned over the years to calm down a lot and really enjoy my work. Like I've enjoyed the last 5-7 years of shooting more than anything else. But the job that was the most fun by 50,000 miles was doing Spamalot on Broadway. Not even close. Grew up a Monty Python geek. I had all those routines memorized before I even started shooting. To work with Eric Idle and to have my first Broadway gig and have it be such a huge success and work with Mike Nichols again after The Birdcage, it was pure hilarious joy for like 2 solid years.
Give me a number to this question. Number of friends over the years who have sent you a text or email about a photo of your ass and along came Paula.
Yeah, that's the over-under on that's got to be a dozen. at least.
Is there anything else that gets that? Is there anything that gets sent to you? Because I do delight every time. I did not know until the other day that you were in Grosse Pointe Blank. Because it's just been so long since I've seen the movie. And when I saw you and you were shot up at that moment, and it felt like you overacted the being shot up. But then I think it was somebody else who actually got shot and not you.
I believe that was a stuntman who fell out the window like that. So give him the note. I assure you I would have died very subtly. The worst of that with my butt is, you know, my poker friends in LA, you know, when that made its way to, you know, cable, which now is instantaneous, but that back then you had to wait, you know, I'd walk in the house and there'd be a freeze frame of, you know, of my ass on the screen for poker night. But, you know, the worst of that was one of the guy's wives was in some show where she had to be naked all the time. Can you imagine that? Just sticking your poker buddy's naked wife up on the screen? Although, actually, I think she turned it down. She was going to do that. And we were all like, oh, boy, here we go. And then lucky for him, she turned that role down.
How does the addiction stuff work with poker, for example? I don't know enough about what triggers are when it comes to addiction. And I found fascinating sort of the way that you made it about codependency, which is something I'd never heard before, even though it might be something that is commonplace in those circles.
I might have mentioned this, forgive me if I'm repeating myself, but as addicts, or at least me, but I think it's all addicts or drunks, or you only engage with the world addictively. It's just a question of degree. So I do everything that way through that lens and model. I'll latch on anything, cupcakes, work, working out, what are some other of my greatest hits? Poker. I never got crazy with gambling. But there was a time, especially when I first got sober about 14 years ago, that I hit the poker really hard. I started playing above my level and like 3-4 times a week and got pretty obsessive with it. And then eventually calmed down and integrated it into a more manageable hobby. But yeah, I'll give me anything. I'll addict to it, some more than others, you know.
Is work the greatest of the sustained addictions? Because you pour yourself in pretty good to the work when you don't really need to be working this way anymore.
Yeah, I've got, again, part of my happiness in the last 5 to 7 years at working is that I don't do that so badly anymore. And I keep it right-sized and balanced. Helps to have a son and a wife that you actually want to get home to. But I think work is a tricky one because work is society sanctioned. Like you go off and you go crazy with drugs and alcohol, people are like, hey, you got a problem. You go nuts that way with work. We're like, good for you. You go. You're supposed to, especially in our society. So it took me a long time to figure that out. I think I mentioned this, Hollywood's your drunken uncle. It's a jealous mistress too. It just wants you doing only that. And then no matter... Jerry Seinfeld one night at the Emmys, he was talking about, he said, like, he got up there. He's like, you know, by definition, everybody in this room who's nominated for an Emmy is an extraordinarily successful person. So we throw this night in television so we can all feel like losers too. And it's kind of like that because 4/5 of the room are going to lose. And it's like, it's never enough. It's always like you compare yourself to the box office and the thing and the whose star is higher and whose stock is higher. And, it's never ending.
Do you have a great debaucherous story from like being with Charlie Sheen or where some of this stuff can be allowed to be fun? Because for a minute there you were, you know, snorting Hollywood. Just the whole experience of it where you were a young person and you're coming upon what had to be a magnificently fun time.
Well, you know, the aforementioned time in Spamalot, I was out of a marriage and, you know, single and like 37, around 40, either side of 40. And I was still drinking. And the Broadway lifestyle very much lends itself. I mean, you get off stage, you know, at 10:30. I would start my night in Manhattan then, usually go all night. And I didn't have to really be awake and alive. If there was a matinee, till earliest 1:30 the next day, usually not till 7:30 p.m. And people were so fun and having such a great time. And that was a really fun phase, you know, just running around like a nut in Manhattan for 2-3 years. I really loved that.
Can you give us any stories that people don't know or something that they might find interesting from your unique perspective about The Simpsons, one of the most amazing television shows that we've ever seen? Is there anything within that that people listening who are fans of The Simpsons would love? Hank Azaria is what? You do 21 of the voices on there?
I mean, more, at this point, around 20 or 30 really regular recurring, and then over the years, dozens and dozens. But some of them are just like one or five times here and there. But I don't know. Fun facts about The Simpsons that people might not know.
It's a difficult question because you're so in the midst of it.
Yeah, but
I want you to imagine a fan. I want you to imagine a fan of the show who just marvels at the genius of the creation. Now, your part of it is, you know, a very specific part of it. But that factory of creation has to be something that the fans of The Simpsons would love to know, how all of that gets done.
Well, it's changed over the years. It's 32 years old, but it started out as sort of a lot of this is well documented, but Matt Groening's a wonderful cartoonist, one of the creators of the show, on the back of a napkin or something, drew the characters on the way into his meeting at Fox to pitch whatever. They became little 1-minute pieces on Tracy Ullman, the Tracy Ullman show, which got a big response. James L. Brooks, who was running that Tracy Ullman show, decided to spin it off because of his incredible power in the business, was able to keep network notes and, corporate interference out, and just went with kind of a pure creative big swing. Also, he had the tremendous vision to hire all these young writers. I've mentioned this, I think, already, to just have a whack at it, including something that had never been done before. People may not know this. You know, if you're lucky enough to create a formula that works, you stick with it. But he would have a different person run that show every like 2 to 3 years. That's nuts. Like, okay, next young guy, you run it now. Next young guy, you run it now. And it kept the show really incredibly alive and fresh because this sort of different radical perspective got brought in. And people would like build on what the last one had done.
That's really smart. That's a good way to stay young. Like it is so hard to keep something like that vibrant across 3 decades.
Well, yes, and I think that's why some people will say that the first 10, 15 years of it were so. I mean, besides the fact that you can't re-break ground. I mean, you can't be re-adventurous or unique. But even apart from that, that was so the model at first. It refused to be formulaic, and that was part of its genius.
Is there any other great wisdom that you have taken across, you know, a quarter century, specifically from, you know, a little cartoon show? Because it really is genius. It's uncommonly smart in terms of just most intelligent television you will find is what it is that you are doing on The Simpsons across many years, where animated come to life, clever is at the top of the charts.
I mean, I got asked this a lot around the turn of the century when it was like voted often the best show of the century. And people would ask me, why do you think that is? I think it's lightning in a bottle. It was the sum being greater than the parts, and a lot of things came together at the right time in society where, you know, somehow the combination of Jim Brooks plus Matt Groening plus Sam Simon and a lot of other writers too, and their equal parts sort of being a visionary and also having the power to see that vision through, very, very rare. And I think that what it was trying to do, which is societal commentary. And of course, do that through an animated show. No one ages. You can actually have an entire town be your cast with only really 6 of us providing all those voices. It was, I didn't realize, I was so young when I engaged in it, I didn't realize how singular it was. It was almost pure, you're right, creativity. It was like only about how can we make this an incredibly smart, interesting, cool thing. And the first 2-3 years was very painstaking. They would write and rewrite and rewrite and rewrite, and we would record like hours upon hours trying to get it right. And then we go back and re-record it again. And they were sort of, I had nothing to compare it to. I didn't know that wasn't normal, but they were very tireless in their pursuit of whatever this vision was. And I think, you know, my personal feeling, having grown up worshiping Warner Brothers cartoons and Bugs Bunny and Mel Blanc, like my hero as an 8-year-old was Bugs Bunny. And then by 12, when I discovered that was Mel Blanc, he became my hero. And in the same way that Bugs Bunny, I could watch it as a 6-year-old and delight in it. And then by the time I'm 16, go, wait a minute, there's a whole nother level to this thing that I wasn't understanding. The Simpsons very much provided that, which the great Pixar movies do. You know, a lot of the greatest stuff does. Like it appeals to children on a very simple level.
Broad net. Yes, you're casting a broad net.
Exactly. And it's working on a whole nother level. So it certainly checks that box. Beyond that, I can't account for it.
Well, explain to the audience how long it takes on average to write a Simpsons episode and how long it would take to animate a Simpsons episode.
Well, at first, it was over a year. I mean, a writer's room, you know, a television season is 22 episodes. Because it takes so long with the animation, normally that's like in a comedy, that's like a 6-month season. For The Simpsons, it's all year round because there's so many parts of the process with the animation. Now they could crank out an episode from beginning to end in like 3 months because of the digital technology. But back then it took a lot longer. And the writer's room is pretty much a normal television writer's room. We'll then read them around a table on Thursdays. They'll rewrite them and have a new script by Friday. We record it pretty much all together, or used to anyway, on a Monday. It takes a few months for what they call the animatic to come back. It's a crude black and white version of, like, a sketch version of the whole show. Based on how that animatic plays, they'll rewrite again. We'll re-record. And then color will come back a few months after that, which is a kind of finished-looking version of the show. But then even that'll get rewritten and tweaked for a few more months. Basically about a year turnaround still for each episode.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it takes a long time.
Have you had any other challenges in your life that felt as formidable as conquering addiction?
Well, listen, I made it sound like it was easy, but it wasn't easy making it in show business. That was a Herculean task. It took a ton of study and obsessiveness and persistence. But, you know, I would say that everything I've done in my life, including being successful in show business, ultimately, or at least having any kind of joy or peace in that success, is a result of overcoming addiction, codependency, that kind of obsession. Perfectionism. Perfectionism's no joke. Sounds like it's a thing you want to say when people interview you for a job, right? What are your faults? Well, I'm a perfectionist. You say it because it sounds great, but it's actually not great.
It makes you good though, Hank. It's a blessing and a curse because I can understand how it would be a crucifix to carry around and just make you crazy and overthink things, but it absolutely has something to do with why you're great at everything.
It does, but I think ultimately, like any addiction, it becomes limiting. I think I'm a much more effective actor, producer now that I don't do that. Pursuing excellence rather obsessively, awesome. But knowing when to let other people do their thing, realizing that the perfect can often be the enemy of the good, is part of being excellent, if you will.
It hurts you so much. It hurts you so much to just look, man, you're excellent at what you do. I don't care what your mommy did to you when you were young or who it is that took your confidence. You're excellent at what you do.
I don't deny that. I think I'm very good. I'm really not. I don't have lack ego in this area. I'm just saying that the same things that made me not enjoy it made me less good at it. I think I could have been even better if I had let some of this stuff go early.
Well, you would have been happier for sure, right? You're happier for sure. Like that is there's real peace and tranquility in working through those demons to arrive where you are right now.
I'll tell you a story about what I'm talking about. You'll enjoy this story. I'm working on a very small movie in that period of time after Birdcage. It was an independent film with Billy Bob Thornton and Ryan Phillippe called Homegrown. Never really amounted to much. But it was in that period of time I got offered all kinds of bunch of stuff, right? So I'm there shooting with Billy Bob. I got a huge kick out of him. He's an amazing guy to work with. And I'm, you know, doing my obsessive perfectionistic thing, as I always do. And it's a little more fraught even than usual because I'm highly aware I'm in a moment where I got to make the most of my opportunities, right? And Billy Bob's not like that at all. And
so much happier. He was eating potatoes like in Hollywood out of his car for 30 days because he didn't have any money for anything. So he developed perspective a lot faster than spoiled Azaria, who got to Hollywood and caught some real breaks real fast.
I guess so. I think also his neurotic eggs don't go in that particular basket. You know, I'm sure he has them elsewhere. But so one day we come into work shooting and Billy Bob says, you know, I had a dream about you last night. I said, really? He said, yeah, I dreamt that all of us were sitting out on a porch. Me and you were sitting out on a porch and John Lennon strolled out with an acoustic guitar and just started playing his songs. And we're sitting there freaking out that John Lennon is playing us his songs. And Billy Bob said, and you wouldn't stop talking the whole time over John Lennon. You were just saying this and that and that and this. And I was like, huh, that was your dream, huh? And I'm taking this and I said, Billy Bob, are you trying to tell me that you wish I'd kind of shut up more on set and let the creative process just happen? And he kind of looked at me not unkindly and thought for a second and went, yeah, I think that's what I'm saying. Yeah.
All right. Let's end on that note. We will pick it up. We will have a whole conversation about Just Apu because I do want to get your thoughts about that stuff because you went through some pretty shitty stuff and you did some brave stuff. So I don't want to neglect it. We'll do it next time. Hank, thanks for spending this time with us. I want to ask you more questions. I can ask you another hour of questions on just this stuff, but thanks for being on with us.
I feel like I owe you money for a therapy session, so thank you.
Our thanks to Hank Azaria for spending that time with us. Again, a request that you rate, subscribe, and review on the Lebatard and Friends Podcast Network. It's what keeps us bringing all of this content to you for free. Next week, Mike Ryan and I will say goodbye to Will Kane from ESPN. I've never spoken to him on air. Next week's South Beach session, we will. We'll talk to Will Kane and say goodbye by giving him a good, swift kick in the ass.